report is back in session.
All right, good afternoon. Go ahead and be seated. And the final matter on today's calendar, docket number 55732, Nevada Mining versus Fulkerson. Are we ready to proceed?
We are, Mr. Chief Justice.
All right, Mr. Schrager, would you like to reserve any time and how much?
Mr. Chief Justice, I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, if I may.
All right.
Mr. Chief Justice, Justices, may it please the Court, and good afternoon. Your Honors, the primary issue in this appeal concerns the initiative power, its meaning, and its limits. Now, there is no dispute in this case that the terms of the initiative petition at stake here form a command to the Nevada legislature. The question here is the exact nature of that command. And because the petition's command is to enact specific, very specific legislation, a tax on the gross proceeds of minerals at a 5% rate, with no room for legislative debate and no room for legislative deliberation, the petition exceeds the limits of the initiative power, and it must therefore be ruled invalid. An initiative, Your Honors, cannot commandeer the legislature. It cannot control the outcome of legislative debates before they occur, or before the legislature being commanded has even been constituted.
Counselor, you're bringing up an argument, if my recollection is correct, about the deliberative prerogatives. Was this argued below?
The fact that this formed an impermissible command to the legislature was our eighth claim for relief. It was in our briefs.
Did you cite any authority for that?
We did not cite these specific cases. However, the very first words out of Judge Wilson's mouth when we entered the courtroom were, "I have read all your materials. I have read your pleadings. I have read your briefs. If you have anything new, please add it." We don't think we've waived the argument. It was our eighth claim for relief.
Did you add anything new?
We did speak at length, Your Honor, and in fact brought up this very question at oral argument.
But no authority?
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
An initiative cannot, in the very simplest terms, cannot tell legislators how to vote on matters that come before them. Article 19, Section 2 of the Nevada Constitution reserves to the people the right to propose initiatives, referenda, and constitutional amendments. It is the people acting in their legislative capacity. And as this court said in Pistol, that power is co-equal, co-extensive, and concurrent with that of the legislature. Those words are important, co-equal, not supreme. It does not override the power of the legislature. It's co-equal. The rules of the process, the rules of the initiative process, matter here. Let me illustrate. Could the people through initiative command the governor to sign a particular bill? The simple answer is no. The wider point is, why would they need to do so? The initiative power is sufficient in and of itself to enact whatever laws the initiative to command the governor would sign. The same thing is true here. Why would proponents need to place this initiative in the form of a command to the legislature to go and enact a law, a very specific law? The power of initiative is sufficient in and of itself for proponents to have enacted that which they are now telling the Nevada legislature to go and do for them. As the California Supreme Court said in the AFL-CIO case, the distinction between an initiative which enacts a statute and one which commands the legislature to go and do that is a narrow one, but it's constitutionally significant. If the people have the power to enact a measure by initiative, they should do so directly. Now, looking through the other initiatives that are on the ballot this time around, and even many of the recent ones, none of them are put in this particular form. None of them tell the legislature to go and pass a highly specific law. None of them encroach upon the legislative deliberative powers that our elected representatives have to have if a legislature is going to function as a legislature. Look, for example, at SJR 2 and SJR 9. The language of those legislative amendments takes great care to say, should the legislature enact? The legislature may enact. If, in fact, the legislature enacts. There's no command to the legislature to go and do those things. Now, SJR 2 and SJR 9 are legislative amendments to the Constitution. By law, they have to be approved at two consecutive legislatures, and then by the people. The question arises, could the first legislature, in this case the 74th Nevada legislature, have approved of this measure and then passed a law ordering the second legislature, the 75th, to approve it as well? The answer to that is, of course not. That would also violate the legislative prerogative of each individually constituted legislature. Now, the responses to this particular argument on the part of proponents are one that it's perfectly acceptable to command the legislature to enact specific laws. They said this is a brand new rule. We've made it up out of whole cloth. Our view, Your Honor, is that, or Your Honors, is that this is a rule as old as the Republic itself. This is the fundamental aspect and quality of the political life of a democratic republic. And all of the cases we've cited, though proponents have pointed out, this particular question has not been before this court before, and this most often arises in the context of initiatives that command legislatures either to push for a constitutional convention or a constitutional amendment.
Mr. Schrager, assuming that this court should consider your argument on this point, should it do so at the pre-election stage? It seems like this issue is an issue that falls in the category of issues that should be evaluated if the initiative passes.
Justice Hardesty, as I understand the prescriptions of Hearst, which is, I really think, what we're talking about here, there are those sets of questions that are perfectly acceptable for pre-election review, procedural review, and there are those sets of questions which are substantive. It seems to me that a substantive question is, if this should pass, it would be, purportedly, violative of some constitutional provision. We're not making those arguments. Though I won't say that I don't think there are portions of this initiative that are not constitutionally defective, I do think there are. We're not making those arguments here. This is a question of process. Can you, in fact, employ the initiative process in this way? At some point in their briefing, proponents say, well, why can't you bring this up later, these entire questions? Well, if, in fact, this were to go on the ballot and succeed, be approved by the people at two successive elections, how could we raise the question then that the initiative was impermissible as an initiative? It seems to me that at that point, the role of what would then be defending a constitutional provision would not devolve to proponents. It would devolve upon the Attorney General. This is a question of whether or not you can use the initiative this way. Pretty much, I believe it's akin to, as this court found in the pistol case, administrative details are not fit subject matter. Use the initiative process to dictate administrative details to the executive branch. This is akin to that. So I think it falls into the category of those questions which are perfectly fit for pre-election review. We would lose these arguments otherwise. Now, every single case we've cited to you speaks of this particular issue, this question of, can the people by initiative commandeer the legislative deliberative process? Even though many of those arise in the context of Article 5 of the federal Constitution, they certainly are not limited to that. Every one of them speaks of this issue in much larger, broader terms. The legislative deliberation cannot exist where the outcome is a predetermined specific action.
If we adopt your approach, Mr. Schlager, how do we avoid the slippery slope of having every initiative petition brought before before the court with a contention that we should throw it off the ballot because it invades the power of the legislature. What would be the rule that the court would adopt that would segregate, in your argument, this initiative petition from a large number of initiative petitions that are presented every election period that might involve subsequent legislative action?
But respectfully, Justice Hardesty, I think there's a difference between subsequent legislative action and the requirement in the text of a petition that the legislature pass a specific piece of legislation without room for deliberation. And that's really the distinction. There are many types of commands one could give to the legislature. For example...
Well, is the command that requires the legislature to meet two-thirds requirement for imposition of taxes invalid because it directs their vote without deliberation?
No, Your Honor. And here's why. That does not foist upon the legislature specific particular legislation. That is a rule that legislation of a specific type must meet that two-thirds requirement. That is very different from saying, and it must be this particular legislation that I've basically written for you, and there shall be no deliberation. For another example, you need look no further than Article 10, Section 1. That also begins, the legislature shall provide by law. The legislature shall provide by law for a uniform and equal rate of assessment and taxation. On some level, that's a command to the legislature. But by its very terms, that command demands the deliberation of legislators. They have to determine whether or not the rates of assessment and the taxation are in fact uniform and equal. It's a rule of policy. Courts can interpret subsequent legislation against that particular tenet.
You don't see that issue as post-election rather than pre-election.
Which issue?
The one you just raised.
If you were judging subsequent legislation to determine whether or not a particular taxation statute were in fact uniform and equal, you would be applying that post-enactment. Absolutely. But Section 10.1 was not placed there by initiative. So the issue here is, can you, through the initiative process, commandeer the legislature, tell it how to vote? And I think that there are particular consequences if, in fact, this aspect of the legislative prerogative is not upheld. And we talked about some of them in our briefing. The legislature is a contentious place.
Mr. Schrager, did you want to talk about the single subject?
I do, Your Honor.
You know what? You got 2 minutes and 30 seconds.
Is that on my 15 or on my 12, Your Honor?
That's what you got left.
Okay. I will say very quickly, because I do want to save some time for rebuttal, we are of the opinion that this is certainly an initiative petition that addresses more than one single subject. There's a shift in taxation of mineral proceeds away from an ad valorem property tax to some other version of property tax. That's a seismic shift. There's a change in the method of valuation from net to gross. Again, a seismic shift in the way minerals are taxed in this state. And it also requires the legislature to set the tax rate on mineral proceeds at not less than 5%. So that even assuming that the change from net to gross may be functionally related or necessarily connected to a fundamental shift in the nature of property taxation, it doesn't necessarily follow that a command to set the rate at precisely 5%, because there is no deliberation here. 5% will, in fact, be what the legislature is commanded to set this tax at. It is certainly not necessary or functionally related to the rest of the initiative that that be done. And I'll reserve the rest of my time, if I may, Mr. Chief Justice.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court. I'm Don Springmeier, representing the proponents. There are areas which are appropriate for pre-election investigation and challenge and discussion, and there are areas that are not. That's what HERC has set for the rule in this state. But before we even get to that, we get to the waiver question. Because when you look at what's happened in this court, and you look at what happened in the district court, you'd think we were talking about two different cases. At the district court level, 98% of their firepower was devoted to the single subject argument and then equal protection and due process, non-constitutional argument. They brought up very faintly and in one place this issue of command to the legislature, but that only turned into a piece of the argument in front of the district court about the description of effect. It nowhere showed up, either by citation of authority, and you look at what they've done in their briefs here, I need a two-handled briefcase to carry these Article 5 cases around with me. There's a raft of them. Not one of them showed up in their discussion and briefing and argument in front of the district court.
Isn't that enough to preserve the issue, at least to raise it on appeal, the fact they didn't weigh it the same way as they're weighing their argument here today?
If it were weight only, I would agree, Your Honor. But this is more like a Trojan horse. It just sat there waiting, and I think what really happened is they lost on the points they were really aiming at in the district court level, so this is the new angle.
Well, people do. I did that as a lawyer. Is that okay? I mean, you know, as long as you raise it, is that sufficient?
But shouldn't the district judge have had an opportunity to evaluate this argument or rule on it? I don't think he did. And I think the transcript and his order show that very clearly. I'll leave that there. The procedural irregularities and specific constitutional or statutory requirements for initiatives are what can be considered pre-election. There is no procedural challenge here. No one's saying there's something wrong with the signature gathering or the copy of the one file doesn't match the copy of the one, none of that stuff. So the permitted pertinent inquiry here is characterized in HERC as the subject matter proper for direct legislative action by the people. And that first takes us to the single subject rule, because that is clearly permitted. It's called for by the statute. And this is an example of a straightforward, simple, unadorned, single subject, are we going to raise taxes on the proceeds of mineral production extracted in Nevada. That's it. There's no other part of the Constitution where the enactment would have an effect. There's no other phrase in the Constitution that changes its meaning because this gets enacted. And the description of effect, as rewritten by Judge Wilson, could not be more stark as to what this is about. So, the single subject, yes, it has two subparts. One is changing net proceeds to gross proceeds. The other part is changing no more than to no less than. Are those functionally related? Are those germane to each other? This is a kind of an odd thing to be arguing with the court because it's completely subjective on the part of the justices. No other case is found in any other appellate decision relating to the changing of this language and whether it amounts to a single subject. This, in essence, devolves into how does this appeal to our common sense? Is changing what's being taxed and what rate will be applied to it, is that functionally related and germane? I say yes. The other side says no. I don't know really what more to say about it than that, except to look at the examples the court has looked at in other cases and say this is not like things the court rejected or has questioned, and is very like and even more simple and more direct and more singular than some of the things the court has approved. And remember, when we're saying approved here, all we're doing is saying approved for the people to vote on. As I said in my brief, this could be wildly popular, and it could be a miserable failure when it comes time for the election. I don't know. But this is a topic. This is a policy statement, a cousin of which is already in the Constitution. Is it proper for the Constitution to say they're not going to be taxed on more than 5% of their net proceeds? Well, if that's proper, why isn't it proper to say they're going to be taxed on no less than 5% of their gross? Those things are not disparate or wildly different. They're about as twin-like as you can imagine. And that is a proper subject, and that is a policy statement, and it's not an administrative detail. And if we had produced a 10-page list of provisions to be enacted as constitutional amendments, the first thing we'd hear about is how about confusing and misleading and non-single subject like that is, because there's too much detail and it is administrative.
So if we allow this to stay on the ballot, though, are we promoting the commandeering of the legislature, of our legislature?
Yeah, I love thinking of myself as a pirate, but, you know, that's not what's happening here. The commandeering of the legislature is a concept that they have created out of these Article 5 cases in which the ballot proponents told the legislature of their state to demand a constitutional convention, for example, of the U.S. Congress. And in every one of those cases, the appellate court said, this is a violation of Article 5 of the United States Constitution. Is that not a substantive constitutional argument? This violates the U.S. Constitution? A couple of those cases also add on a state law basis for overturning, blocking the initiative from the ballot. But those cases refer to it then as a plebiscite or a public opinion poll. And they say our state does not allow for a plebiscite or a public opinion poll. I don't know what this court would say about that after Kimball v. Swackhammer, but that's what all of those cases are about. It's a federal violation of the federal constitution under Article 5. Therefore, you can't do it. Well, how could that be more substantive constitutional argument than a violation of equal protection or a violation of the due process clause? So, A, that's exactly the kind of thing the court has said we should not be looking at here. It's a substantive constitutional argument that comes after the election happens, after two elections happen, and if it's passed. But beyond that, Your Honor, the fact on which they presume and which they rely on is that the command, supposedly, to the legislature is A, impermissible, and B, can only require one action. Let me start by saying that the Constitution already says the legislature shall provide by law in Article 10, Section 5. It's not the ballot initiative that says the legislature shall. The Constitution says the legislature shall. What we're changing is the topic which is following the command to the legislature. And their premise is that that command can only be specific at 5%, but there's a hidden assumption there. That assumption is that Article 10, Section 2, which caps the total tax levy on property at 5%, applies to this provision of the Constitution on net proceeds, and their argument depends upon the fact that the legislature might not do something else. So, my response to that is, when they took it upon themselves to move them, the taxation of mines, to a different part of Article 10, and they arranged for Section 1 to say, except mines and mining claims which shall be assessed and taxed only as provided in Section 5, they took away the shield they had in Section 2 which provides for the 5% cap. And additional support for that comes from the fact that Section 5 talks about not to exceed 5%. Well, why would you need that if you were already protected by Section 2 and the 5% cap? The only reason you need that is because you have now carved yourself away from the general protections of Article 10 and made yourself being subject only to the provisions of Section 5. Okay. Well, that means we can change Section 5 if enough people decide they want to do that.
Mr. Springmeier, excuse me. Have your clients turned in their signatures yet to the Secretary of State? Because I think there's a deadline of June 15th.
Well, first there has to be a certification with the county clerks, and so neither of those has happened yet.
No. Okay, thank you.
So, where I'm going with that is, it can be more than 5%, because they took themselves out of the protective shield of Section 2 of Article 10. And even then, it still depends on some action of the legislature in the future, should it pass. Suppose the legislature does enact it at 5. Is there a constitutional violation there? Not even they could argue that. If they enact it at 6, then yes, we'll be back up here presumably with the Mining Association saying, this violates the 5% cap. And we will argue, no, it doesn't, because it doesn't apply to you. But none of that means anything until after the elections, until after action by the legislature. Now, beyond that, and we're talking about commandeering the legislature, I direct you to Article 10, and this is subsection 6 of Section 1. This is in the Constitution right now. And if this isn't a specific command to the legislature to take action with no deliberation, I won't believe it. It says, the legislature shall provide by law for a progressive reduction in the tax upon business inventories by 20% in each year following the adoption of this provision, and after the expiration of the fourth year, such inventories are exempt from taxation. Where is the deliberation there? They're telling the legislature, you're going to reduce this 20% a year, and that's the end of it. So that's one of several other commands, if we want to call them that, that we have cited in our brief. It is perfectly appropriate for the Constitution to command the legislature to do something. It is perfectly within the definition of the purpose and powers of a constitution to bind future legislatures. What good would a constitution be if it couldn't bind future legislatures? I agree, the cases say legislatures can't bind future legislatures, governors can't bind future governors, milk boards can't bind future milk boards, but not one of those cases says a constitution cannot bind a future legislature. And that's because there is no such case, because it can. And that's exactly what a constitution is for. So there's no commandeering. This is perfectly within the bounds of things already in the Constitution and not rejected anywhere by case law in any other state. So I circle back to the idea that this argument about commandeering the legislature is a disguised constitutional defectiveness argument, and that it was waived, and this ballot initiative meets the single subject requirement easily. Its description of effect is out there in the open, and people may hate it and people may like it, but they're going to know what they're voting for. And this is exactly the kind of thing this court should let go to the vote of the people, and there are later events, should it pass twice, when constitutional infirmities can be argued by those impacted by the tax and defended. I don't know what difference it makes whether the Attorney General is defending an existing law or the proponents are defending an attempted initiative. I'm not sure why that means it should have one outcome versus another. But Those are the kinds of things that this court says we should discuss after it passes, and only if it passes. Thank you.
All right, colleagues, any questions? All right, thank you.
Your Honors, thank you again. Just a couple of things to follow up from what counsel said. First of all, the section in Article 10.1, Section 6, that has to do with the ironclad and obvious command that the legislature shall provide for law for a progressive reduction in tax, et cetera, was in the original Constitution. It expired, those provisions, in 1869. The initiative process was not instituted in Nevada until 1912. I don't know that the existence of that particular information for 4 years of validity in the original Constitution sort of stands for the support that counsel would like it to. At any rate, this case is not about what can or cannot appear in a Constitution. It's about what one can do through the initiative process. And furthermore, going to Article 10, Section 1, counsel, I think, has misread the section involving except mines and mining claims. This case involves a tax on mineral proceeds. Mineral proceeds in this state are property. We've given you case after case after case for 150 years, and all of them say mineral proceeds are property. If that's going to change, that's a pretty big subject, and that itself.
Finish your
thinking. That itself would constitute a fairly large alteration in the way in which we value property in this state. If that's what we're altering, I think everyone should know that. But as it is, there are no cases for the entirety of Nevada history saying that mineral proceeds are anything other than property and the tax upon them is anything other than a property tax. And as such, necessarily, the 5% cap in 10.2 has to apply. There is no other way around that. Any questions?
Any questions? All right, counsel, we appreciate your briefs and your argument today, and this matter will stand submitted. And we will stand in recess until the next call of the court.
All rise.